The last giant of the scientific revolution before Newton was René Descartes, 1596-1650, whom some proclaim the father of modern philosophy. Others denounce him as the source of our contemporary alienation. Born in Brittany, his Celtic heritage may explain his rather eccentric behavior, more akin to a romantic poet than a philosopher-scientist. By his own account, he conceived his famous classic, Discourse on Method, while meditating in a stove. It seemed that he had joined the barbarian army, as he said, to escape his friends, who distracted his philosophical meditations. Now, you have to admit, that action in itself does not exactly constitute ordinary behavior. Join the army to meditate? Anyway, during a blinding snowstorm that lasted for weeks in the Alps, he climbed inside a stove and meditated all day long. Evidently, barbarian stoves at that time had double walls. A thin man could slip in between the walls and stay very toasty. In his stove sojourn, he experienced three visions that not only transformed his life, but reshaped the Western concept of reality for the next 300 years. Mystics speak of a catastrophic vision, the vision of desolation. St. John of the Cross called it the dark night of the soul. Apparently, Descartes experienced such visions which plunged him into the throes of despondency. He began to doubt everything he ever knew or understood. He could no longer trust the revelations, the statements, the theories of any authority figure, religious or political. Then, turning his skepticism upon himself, he doubted the validity of his own senses. How does he truly know he sits here by the fire in a dressing gown? Perhaps he only dreams or hallucinates. His very body may be an illusion. This method of Cartesian doubt, as it came to be called, extended even to arithmetic and geometry, number and extension. God may cause me to make a mistake whenever I try to count the sides of a square or add 2 and 3. If not God, maybe a demon. Then again, God and the demon could be phantoms of my imagination. Or the universe itself, could be a dream of a nameless dreamer. Chuang Tzu, the Taoist philosopher and poet, summarized this quandary most beautifully. Once Chuang Tzu dreamt he was a butterfly. Suddenly he woke up, and there he was, Chuang Tzu. But he really didn't know if he was Chuang Tzu, who had dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly, dreaming he was Chuang Tzu. There remains, however, one thing Descartes could not doubt: the existence of the thinker who doubts. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Upon the single rock of certainty, a self-evident first principle, he would build a new science of nature. scientific philosophy. It's an awesome task that no one had dared to undertake since Aristotle. Did he succeed? Yes, to an astounding degree. He created the conceptual framework, the interpretation of this emerging paradigm, classical scientific realism. This worldview not only molded the sciences of the 18th and 19th centuries, but also the arts, philosophy, the value system of the Enlightenment, and even influenced the development of modern economic thought and government. In brief, Descartes created much of the reality of modern Western culture up to the 20th century. What was the shape and essence of Cartesian Descartes' reality? Still thingness, although thingness with a vengeance. Starting with the certainty of a thinking mind, which he named res cogitans. Remember, res, the Latin root of reality. Res cogitans, the thinking thing. He then had to determine the existence of God. Well, this he did in a rather superficial way, in a scholastic manner, by harking back to the first cause argument derived from Aristotle's argument of the unmoved mover. Everything finite has a cause, which in turn has its own cause, which has its cause, etc., etc., etc. But eventually, it has to stop somewhere. There must be a beginning, an uncaused cause. Obviously, the uncaused cause of everything is God. Now, having established the reality of God to his satisfaction, he then presumes the reality of the physical world, because God would not deceive the thinking mind by perceptions that are illusions. Therefore, Descartes reasons, the external world which we perceive must exist. Such physical reality or matter he called res extensa, the extended thing. Contrast his perspective with the Hindu-Buddhist concept of Maya, wherein all physical reality is indeed illusion, the only true reality being mind essence. If Descartes had really carried his skepticism to its ultimate premise, he might have reached a similar conclusion. Nowhere does he prove thoughts need a thinker. The statement, I think, is an assumption. The only reality he perceives are thoughts, not the I who thinks them. Incidentally, to Descartes, thoughts were not just logical deductions. A thing that thinks, he said, understands, conceives, desires, imagines, and feels the total mind experience. Actually, his skepticism never did crack the ego barrier. He never doubted the visions that created the doubt, convinced they came from God. They could have just as easily come from traces of carbon monoxide breathed in that damnable stove which certainly would have generated despondency. Of such nebulous stuff, reality is created. In Descartes' rather bleak portrayal of the cosmos, only two realms exist. The thinking thing, mind, and the extended thing, matter. Mind he equated with the rational soul of Aristotle. And since the mind-soul is totally independent of the body and cannot be acted upon by the body, the only possible connection or bridge between these two realms would be God. Cartesian dualism merely continued the dualism of spirit and body, which began with Pythagoras, probably influenced by Thracian shamanism, flowered with Plato, and nourished by Christian philosophy. Even modern science inherited the patrimony, as witnessed by the perennial debate on brain versus mind. Although Descartes remained a practicing Catholic, educated by the Jesuits, he knew that the Inquisition would eventually brand him a heretic, since he advocated two heretical doctrines, the Earth's rotation and the infinity of the universe. After the condemnation of Galileo, Descartes fled to Holland, the one country in Europe during the 17th century where you were free to speculate about anything under the sun, including the location of the sun itself. What other country would have sheltered the likes of John Locke or Spinoza, or published the works of David Hume? But even here, Catholics and conservative Protestants accused Descartes of atheism and would have put him on trial, except for the personal intervention of the ruler, Prince of Orange. Despite such accusations, Descartes had made God essential to his scientific philosophy. During the ensuing years, however, scientists gradually omitted the God connection and concentrated primarily upon the nature of matter. Which is ironic, because the premise of I think, therefore I am, makes mind more certain than matter. Like Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus, Descartes believed the physical universe, res extensa, matter, is governed by mathematical laws, of which God, in his goodness, allows the human mind to comprehend. In his effort to reduce all physical interactions to mathematical relationships, he once said, "My entire physics is nothing other than geometry." His belief may have been reinforced by his own mathematical brilliance. He created analytical geometry. If God is a supreme mathematician, then it follows that physical reality must be constructed in a logical manner. All parts should interact in accordance with some master equation. And seemingly it does. To judge by Kepler's laws of celestial motion and Galileo's laws of bodies in motion. Then, at this point, Descartes' intuition fashioned a simple, compelling image that became the dominant metaphor of Western culture for the next 300 years. The universe is a machine. Now, of course, he didn't think of it as a metaphor, rather an accurate description of reality. But what better model could be presented than that noblest autonomous machine of the day, the mechanical clock? The universe, Descartes declared, functions like a clock, originally set in motion by God. H. Butterfield, in his book, The Origins of Modern Science, writes, "The aspiration to demonstrate that the universe ran like a piece of clockwork was initially a religious aspiration. It was felt that there would be something defective in creation itself, something not quite worthy of God, unless the whole universe could be shown to be interlocking, so that it could carry the pattern of reasonableness and orderliness." End of quote. To complete this pattern of mechanistic orderliness, one must logically conclude that all life forms are machines too. Self-moving, self-generating machines. Automata. The same word origin as automatic or automobile. In the 17th century, the potentiality of machines fascinated people, much in the same manner as our love affair with computers. The Industrial Revolution, with the advent of the power loom and the steam engine, was still 100 years in the future. Nevertheless, the dreams of unlimited machine power bedazzled the mind and beckoned the imagination. Wealthy patrons tried to outdo each other by constructing elaborate gardens to house these delightful mechanical toys, artificial fountains and waterfalls and picturesque mills, birds that sing and flap their wings, exotic animals displaying lifelike movements. But most impressive of all were those incredible replicas of human beings performing the most natural actions. A Baroque prophecy of Disneyland. Descartes himself constructed a few of these human automata and concluded, "I do not recognize any difference between the machines built by craftsmen and the various bodies that nature alone composes." However, he did distinguish one difference between humans and animals. Humans possessed a rational soul, the mind, while animals represented complete autonomy, devoid of any feelings or consciousness. If the kernel of Descartes' theory of knowledge consists of his cogito, "I think, therefore I am," then his method of accumulating and verifying knowledge is analytical and logical, still characteristic of French philosophy today. When presented with a problem, you first reduce the whole to its constituent parts, and then rearrange those separate parts into a logical pattern. The Cartesian method allows the scientist to develop simplicity and universality in a series, while at the same time solving the most complex technological procedures. Whatever its faults, Descartes' mechanistic, reductionistic worldview became the reality for Western culture. And you have to say that in the last 300 years, science has made more advances than the previous 2,000 years. The end of Descartes' life provided a tragi-comical twist almost as bizarre as the stove incident. He sent a treatise on love, in which he certainly was no authority, to Queen Christina of Sweden, a learned and fiercely independent woman. Enthralled by his unique views, the queen dispatched a warship to bring him to her. When he arrived, somewhat overwhelmed, she informed him she would become his student. But the only free time she had was 5 o'clock in the morning. Poor Descartes, who could only think when warm, had to get up every morning in the bitter cold of Swedish winter and trudge through the snow to the royal study. After a few months, he caught pneumonia and died.